Senate Committee on Rules and Elections, Thursday, April 15th, 4:30 p.m., here in Room B, Chair Senator Charles Stubbs.
In the Senate Committee on Rules and Elections, in the form of a subcommittee at the moment, and that we might begin to take testimony. So I'm opening a public hearing on SGR 21, invite Senator Metzger. Senator, I'm not here. Senator Corcoran, you're going to be testifying on this as well. All right.
I see you. And David, as I said, I know more than we'll be testifying, but we can get Judge Lindy, why don't you just go ahead and come on and sit up here? We'll kind of expedite the process.
Thank you. Right. You're the important one, Judge.
You want to go in? Thank you, Mr. Chair and member of the committee. For the record, I'm Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 14, and with me is retired Judge Hans Lindy and Senator Tony Corcoran. And as I mentioned, all the others that will be testifying. I'll be very brief on my remarks. Judge Lindy could probably handle more of the technical issues, but SJR 21 seeks to address what is a serious problem with the continuing glut in our state constitution. And if you've had a chance to look at it recently, it is now up to 57 pages long. And rather than being a structure of government and a framework for establishment of law, it has now become a document of law by itself. It's interesting to note, right after the Bill of Rights, we start talking about inmate work provisions. We talk about veteran bonuses, pollution credits. People have attempted to put contractual requirements into our Constitution. And placement of laws in the Constitution is in itself, many believe, inherently unconstitutional. Judge Lindy has written extensively on this subject as well. But I think it's incumbent upon all of us that we preserve the framework of our Constitution, make sure that it does serve as the framework for the establishment of law, and that the state of Oregon does not to continue this treacherous path of having two sets of law. SGR 21 seeks to do this, and the essential principle is by having the Secretary of State, when a petition is filed for an amendment to the Constitution, to have a determination that would be likely made by the Attorney General at the request of the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State would make a determination as to whether the provisions that were requested to go to the people could be enacted by statute. And if, in fact, those provisions could be enacted by statute, then they must be offered to the public that way and not as a constitutional amendment. This would be reviewed by, there's a -1 amendment that you may have by now that came out of consultation with Judge Lindy and Charlie Hinkle and other constitutional scholars regarding overview, for review by the Oregon Supreme Court. But what I believe this does, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is that it does not in any way infringe upon the right of the electorate to change the laws of the state, but to make sure that we have the proper structure in our state government. It's long overdue. Judge Lindy, in his comments, either now or in some of the materials that he will be supplying you, has indicated that there has been attempts in the past to clarify this language, and we came very close in 1994 with an amicus brief that was filed on ATIA versus the state of Oregon, and there were some very notable individuals, David Frohmeyer, Judge Lindy, Mayor of Portland, former Supreme Court judges, indicating that the 1902 law of the initiative process has been misused in this SGR 21 attempts to solve that problem. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Senator Corcoran first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Tony Corcoran, Senate District 22. This will be going from the ridiculous to the sublime because you get Judge Lindy next, but I simply want to affirm my support for this bill and to tell you that over the years of experience that I've had both as a union official working for and against ballot measures, and as a legislator, I feel very strongly that Senator Metzger is going in absolutely the right direction with this measure, and it doesn't take much more than a brief review of the Oregon Constitution to determine that it's become this mishmash, very disorganized mishmash, and basically it's come down to a money game. The capacity for people to put ballot measures, constitutional ballot measures up for election is almost related directly to the amount of money they can raise for signature, and I don't think that's what the Founding Fathers envisioned with the initiative and referendum process. So with that, I'll shut up and turn it over to the judge. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman Stahl and members of the committee. I'll be equally brief. Actually, Senator Metzger has made the case for it very clearly in his opening statement, and I'm not going to speak much longer than that. It is, for those of us who are not in politics, but just working with the Constitution, I've been a taught state and federal constitutional law for many, many years before and after I served on the Supreme Court. I was a member of the 1962-63 Constitutional Revision Commission. So this has been sort of a life profession for me, working on these things. And what has happened in the last decade has been a great departure from the tradition of constitutions being about governing, about the structure and the procedures of government and the individual rights against government, and putting a lot of material into the Constitution that previously had always been left to change from a year-to-year basis. But I can add to what has been said before. This is indeed one of the most serious contemporary problems. And what I can add to what has been said is that as early as 1903, the year after the First Initiative Amendment went into effect, 1902, it was challenged in the Oregon Supreme Court as being inconsistent with the requirement that every state have a Republican form of government. And the Supreme Court unanimously said, no, it was not inconsistent. You could have an initiative. But the reason the Supreme Court gave in this first case, it's never been changed, is that the reason is that the legislature continues to have the power to change the laws. That's why the Republican government continues as long as the legislature is free to change the law. That was the major premise for that outcome. So when you start changing and putting laws in the Constitution and tying the hands of the legislature, you people know the problem better than I do. I mean, you know that you have people forcing expenditures in the tens of millions of dollars that are unfunded on the one hand, and you have people cutting taxes on the other hand, without any substitute tax or any cut in expenditures, and then you're supposed to balance a budget. It simply is a misuse of the Constitution. So what I have, we've got the copies up there. What I've given you is from a case which is explained in the historical note. You can read it for yourselves from the law review, the Willamette law review of the current issue. It sets out the history of that particular litigation, and it's an amicus curiae brief that Dave Hohenmeier, who of course also is a longtime teacher in this field and a member of this legislature, attorney general, and president of the University of Oregon now. We filed this brief to demonstrate why we think putting laws into the Constitution is improper under the U.S. Constitution. It doesn't mean you can litigate it. What the court did with this, by the way, is he held it moot because there was a companion case that they could decide on a different ground. So the brief is here because the case was never led to an opinion. And so the law review thought at least people should have the argument in front of them at that time. What I'm prepared to do is I think the amendment is well drafted. I think there may be ways for the legislature to accomplish this without having to refer an amendment to the voters, but I don't want to take your time unless the committee is interested in pursuing this. I'd be happy to be of help if I can. So I'm prepared to answer questions.
Questions?
Thank you, Judge. Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask David Honeycutt. Oh, you have a question?
I did have a question. I don't know if you can do it in great length, but I'm curious, how would the legislature address it without going to a referral to the voters?
It doesn't take great length. It does not take a long answer. If the brief that you have there is even approximately correct, and we think it is, you can simply say by statute that the Attorney General shall make a determination whether the proposed amendment is necessary. That is to say, whether the existing Constitution requires it. Otherwise, he shall tell the sponsors they have to submit it as a statute. It's simply a directive to the Secretary of State. The only disagreement, the only difference between this proposal that Senator Metzger put forward, and I just saw it for the first time yesterday, so I can't tell you that I've been delaying here. I mean, when I saw it, I said to him, I think you can probably do this by a statute. You can just say, the Secretary of State, if it doesn't have to be a constitutional amendment, and it has this sort of content. I mean, there are other constitutional amendments, like changing the office of Secretary of State or something. You have to amend the Constitution. But these substantive things, if you don't need a constitutional amendment, tell the sponsors to turn it in as a statute. Yes. I think you can do that. I think I can't promise you. My guess is you'd have a very good chance the Oregon Supreme Court will sustain that statute. Any other questions?
Just a follow-up. Assuming that we could do it statutorily, mm-hmm. Do you think it makes sense politically to do it that way?
You're asking just an ivory tower academic?
Yeah, I am.
What do I know? You people are the politicians. Yes, I think it is.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why. I think it is because I believe that what most people are interested in is whether they get to vote on the issue. Then most people don't know the difference, whether it's a constitutional amendment or a statute. The sponsors do, but the voters don't. I think to them, it's the substance that they're interested in. If somebody says to them, sure, you can vote for this or against this as you wish, we're just telling you this isn't really something that ought to be an amendment, should be a statute. They think of that as a technical problem, as it is. It's a legal problem. It's not a political problem as far as the ordinary voter is concerned. That's why we get some of these crazy things in the Constitution, because people are just interested in the text. They're not interested in whether it's a constitutional amendment.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
All right.
Pleasure.
Have a nice day.
Just real quick.
Sure.
So the effect, if that was accomplished and the Attorney General looked at one and said this doesn't require a constitutional amendment, would merely be that it would be submitted as a statutory change?
Yes.
It doesn't deny the...
Oh, no, of course. It would be a statute.
Go on.
Look, there's an additional provision in the Metzger draft, which I think is also equally desirable in the other case. Since the Attorney General's advice may be erroneous, the losing side, whoever wants to do it the other way or thinks it ought to be done the other way, can get judicial review. And you need the provision that it goes directly to the Supreme Court, as all these other ballot measures go there, so that you have a very short time frame. You need a very quick method of review because of the time frame in which you have to decide whether it goes on, whether the petitions... It has to happen before the petitions are circulated. So there's an expedited judicial review provision in these other election laws. You just want to be sure it also gets into this one. Any other questions?
Thank you. I believe that answers our questions, Dave.
Thanks.
Honeycutt.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt. Normally you would see me as a lobbyist for Oregon's in action. Today I am here in my personal capacity. You can tell this isn't a land use bill because Senator Corcoran and I agree on this issue. I think I can come at this bill or this resolution from a little bit different perspective from the first three speakers that you had. I was a co-petitioner on ballot measure 65 in the last election, the administrative rule reform measure, and having served in that capacity and having drafted ballot measure 65 with pledge counsel, I know how difficult the initiative process is and how difficult it is to get the signatures and how and the work that's entailed in actually getting an initiative on the ballot. And believe me, it's a difficult process. I'm very protective of that process and strongly support the initiative process. At the same time, one of the most damaging things to our campaign and the ballot measure 65 campaign was a voter's pamphlet statement from the former Dean's Committee that alleged that ballot measure 65, which was a constitutional amendment, could have been placed in statute. They referred to the measure as constitutional clutter, despite the fact that we had a letter from the dean of the Northwestern School of Law, Lewis and Clark, indicating that to put an administrative rules measure in statute would violate the separation of powers provision of the Constitution. That's why we didn't. You know, I would have had to gather about 20,000 less signatures to put it on the ballot via a statutory amendment, and certainly would have been more than happy to do so if we could, but we didn't believe that we could. In any event, with that argument in the voters' pamphlet, that was a very powerful argument, we lost the measure 65, we lost measure 65 52% to 48%, and I can't help but believe that some of the no votes we received on that measure were in large part due to that voter's pamphlet statement. Had this resolution been in place, we would have had a determination by the Secretary of State as to whether or not ballot measure 65 would have been able to be placed into the statutes, or whether it was required to be a constitutional amendment. And had that been in place, I don't think we would have had an argument from the former Dean's Committee, which may, for us, have turned the outcome on ballot measure 65. So I think it's important, and I certainly don't see a problem with allowing a review of an initiative, of a proposed initiative, to see whether or not it qualifies whether it should be a constitutional amendment because it can't be placed in statute, or whether it should be a statutory amendment if it can be placed there. I think that's a fine idea, and I actually think that will help save the initiative process rather than harm it. For those reasons, I support Senate Joint Resolution 21. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Any further questions? Senator Brown.
My sense is that one of the reasons why folks have measures to be constitutional as opposed to statutory, so we can't put our fingerprints on it. Is that your sense? And if that is in fact the case, that you think this may result in, well, probably, if that is the case, then this may bomb out at the ballot box.
Chair Starr, Senator Brown, I think that is the case, and with certain resolutions, that certainly wasn't, or with certain initiatives, that certainly wasn't the case with ours. The reason we put it in the Constitution is because we felt that there wasn't any other place for it. We couldn't put it in statute. But I think that's a concern, and if this is put onto the ballot, it may have a difficult time passing. Although at the same time, I think Justice Lindy had a point. The people want to vote on the issue. I'm not sure that they're concerned with whether or not it's a constitutional amendment or it's a statutory amendment. I'm not sure people actually look at that in that big of a detail.
Sure. Let me ask you the same question I asked Justice Lindy, and that is, if in fact we were able to do it statutorily, do you think politically that would be a wise move?
Well, Chair Starr, Senator Brown, I think you would probably be faced at that point with a referendum, which would require 4% of the signatures, 4% of the voters who voted in the last governor's race, as opposed to if you put it on the ballot itself, it wouldn't be subject to a referendum. If it's on the ballot, if you're just throwing it out on the ballot politically, that's probably more palatable than trying to amend it through statute. One other caveat that I didn't mention, I talked to Senator Metzger about this morning.
If you look at my written testimony, I suggest in my testimony that you consider amendments which would authorize a quick appeal of any decision made by the Secretary of State, because there would be, I don't think there would be anything more unfair than to have a group or an individual go out and gather signatures, have the Secretary of State say that this can be a statutory amendment, put that on the ballot, have it pass, then have it challenged with the appellate court saying that should have been a constitutional amendment. It's not the fault of the people who gathered the signatures that the Secretary of State made an error. So what I would propose is that, and I think the dash ones that Senator Metzger have create a process where you can have a quick determination by the appellate courts whether or not the Secretary of State's decision was correct. And with that, I think you've got a good resolution.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask, but I will concur with the thoughts of the distinguished minority leader with respect to why people seek to put things into the Constitution that they could probably, and I know you were uncertain, or at least you thought you had good legal advice, and maybe you did, as to where this measure belonged, but what I'm struggling with in this is to whom does the ORS belong, and to whom does the Constitution belong? And if part of the campaign on Measure 66 or anything else was, does it belong in statute or in the Constitution, that is something that is argued by the electorate. And I personally don't fear that. And this just kind of sounds like, to me, we are, I realize this is referred to the people, but it sounds like we're getting a little bit protective, and we're exercising the judgment that we fear this clutter, and that, by golly, citizens, we're not going to allow that clutter to take place anymore.
At Chair Starr, Senator Miller, I share those concerns. At the same time, I also am concerned that if we continue on with the path we're going, where we have multiple initiatives on each ballot measure, that eventually we may reach the point where somebody will put on as an initiative a ballot measure to substantially restrict the initiative process. I believe that SJR 21 will actually help protect the initiative process. I'm a firm believer in the initiative process. I've used it, or probably our organization will probably use it again. At the same time, I don't want to see it restricted to the point where it's impossible for a grassroots organization like ours to use it. And so anything that we can do that tempers the process without essentially gutting it, I think is valuable.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Anyone else want to testify? We have Suzanne Townsend with Deputy Secretary of State. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Starr, members of the committee, just for the record, Suzanne Townsend. I'm Deputy Secretary of State. I'm here to speak on this, SJR 21, on behalf of the Secretary. We are very sympathetic to the problem attempting to be addressed by this measure, as it's been articulated by all four of the prior speakers. However, as it's currently drafted, the Secretary is unable to support SJR 21. Our primary concern is that this measure or resolution proposes a significant policy shift that gives wide-ranging discretion and authority to the Secretary of State, but as it's currently drafted, doesn't provide any guidance about how that discretion and authority should be exercised. The measure provides that the Secretary shall make the decision as provided by law. However, in the measure itself, there isn't any indication about what that would be. And as far as I've been able to determine, there is no companion legislation spelling that out either. As it's written, the resolution would be voted on in the May 2000 primary. If it passes, we would be attempting to implement the requirements right after that. We would be getting petitions in July of 2000 for measures that are headed for the 2002 general election. But the sooner the legislature would have an opportunity to consider what type of direction to provide us would be January 2001, unless it's done this session. Thus, assuming no companion statute is passed this session, we would be attempting to implement this resolution without any guidance or direction from the legislature at all. And that gives us some great hesitation. Of course, the current secretary would only be dealing with this problem for about 6 months, so the bulk of this would be with the new Secretary of State coming in January of 2001. We currently make a number of constitutional procedural decisions about initiative measures, whether there's a single subject, more than one amendment, does the measure propose a revision rather than an amendment to the Constitution. But the kind of decision that would be asked to make under this resolution is significantly more difficult. We would be dealing with substantive areas of the Constitution. Many of the areas of the Constitution have not been litigated before, so we would not even have court guidance. Senator Metzger mentioned that he believed that this Attorney General would be making the decisions, and I respectfully disagree with that. The measure as written says that the Secretary of State would make the decision about the constitutionality. We would seek legal advice. Clearly, we don't have to, by the way, but it would be unwise not to, and we certainly would seek legal advice. But what we get from the Attorney General is advice, not the decision. And as most of you probably are aware, having dealt with lawyers in the past, the question that you ask a lawyer in many instances determines the answer that you get. If we ask, for instance, is there any ethical argument that could be made that this measure is constitutional, we might get one answer. If we ask, what is the court likely to decide if this measure is challenged, we could get another answer. So the discretion is indeed with the secretary, whether or not to get legal advice, how to ask the question, and ultimately what decision to make about the substantive constitutional issues. That's a significant shift. It provides one elected official with tremendous power over the initiative process. The policy about whether to go forward is one that ought to be debated heavily. And we would particularly appreciate some additional guidance or direction from the legislature about how to make decisions that are as momentous as these.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Byers.
So understanding the secretary's concern, would the secretary be more supportive if we took Judge Lindy's advice, if we went this way and just made the Attorney General the arbiter on this?
Boy, you know, we didn't talk about that, so I'm not sure that I could express his opinion. I think that the same issue would be present, however, that without some guidance from the legislature about how to make that determination, it puts a really significant amount of discretion in one elected official's lap.
So you don't think the Attorney General generally would have the legal knowledge to decide whether something could be placed in statute rather than needed to be in the Constitution?
I'm not questioning at all the legal abilities of the Attorney General, and that's the office I came from most recently before this job. But as clear from the litigation that we have over the procedural issues even now and other constitutional issues, legal minds can differ. You hear Justice Lindy articulate, for instance, the position about the Republican form of government and whether or not these measures can even go into the Constitution. That isn't a position that is uniform by any means, and it's a very significant legal debate right now, and there's a lot of that going on. So to whomever you give the decision-making authority here, there is a significant amount of leeway, and that's the point.
But if we were to add, as we have with a number of issues in the last couple of sessions, very quick turnaround review by the Supreme Court, direct access to the court, wouldn't we mm-hmm. resolve that rather quickly and develop the case law necessary?
That would certainly make for some quick decisions. Again, that is an amendment that we just recently saw, and I haven't discussed it in any detail with the Secretary. But I would simply point out with my legal hat on that one of the things that we have had in the past is
on this?
Boy, you know, we didn't talk about that, so I'm not sure that I could express his opinion. I think that the same issue would be present, however, that without some guidance from the legislature about how to make that determination, it puts a really significant amount of discretion in one elected official's lap.
So you don't think the Attorney General generally would have the legal knowledge to decide whether something could be placed in statute rather than needed to be in the Constitution?
I'm not questioning at all the legal abilities of the Attorney General, and that's the office I came from most recently before this job. But as clear from the litigation that we have over the procedural issues even now and other constitutional issues, legal minds can differ. You hear Justice Lindy articulate, for instance, the position about the Republican form of government and whether or not these measures can even go into the Constitution. That isn't a position that is uniform by any means, and it's a very significant legal debate right now, and there's a lot of that going on. So to whomever you give the decision-making authority here, there is a significant amount of leeway, and that's the point we're trying
to. But if we were to add, as we have with a number of issues in the last couple of sessions, very quick turnaround review by the Supreme Court, direct access to the court, wouldn't we mm-hmm. resolve that rather quickly and develop the case law necessary?
That would certainly make for some quick decisions. Again, that is an amendment that we just recently saw, and I haven't discussed it in any detail with the Secretary. But I would simply point out with my legal hat on that one of the things that we have had in the past is when constitutional issues are raised, you generally have the debate in the trial court, and they go on up through the Court of Appeals, and there are several layers of process before you get a final constitutional decision. And so I think some consideration has to be given to whether or not you really want fast decisions on the Constitution or whether you want that layered argument and debate on the way up from the trial court. I just toss that out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
It's obvious, I think, that we're going to do some further work on this before we bring it back. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on SCR 21. And I appreciate very much the testimony and you bringing the bill to us. I'll visit with you about how we might proceed. I'm going to open the work session on drafting and major introduction to take care of that quickly.
Mr. Chairman,
I would move that we approve the following requests for drafting and bill introduction, and those requests would be dated 4/13/99, and one request is dated 4/15/99.
Thank you. Senator Miller has moved that we approve the following bill drafting and bill introductions, two requests dated 4/13/99 and one request dated 4/15/99. Any objections? If not, so ordered. We will open a public hearing on SJR 34 and invite Inez Weissman and Paul Romain to come forward. This is a bill that I introduced at the request of Inez and
thank you so much. I'm delighted, of course, to be here and to have an opportunity to speak on behalf of this, I can only refer to it as soul-stirring resolution. It's interesting that it occurred this week, because this week commemorates the tragedy of the Holocaust. And it is but a few days following the Passover holiday of the Jews, which is the remembrance of the history of the past and the promise of the future.
Excuse me, would you introduce yourself for the
record? Oh, certainly. I'm Inez Weissman. I live in Lake Oswego, Clackamas County. I'm chairman of the Oregon chapter of Americans for a Safe Israel and national coordinator of the Alliance for Israel. And again, I'm delighted to be here. How wonderful that through the good graces of Senator Starr and those assembled here, we can together remember the past, take pride in today, and share hope for the future at a very difficult time for all of us in our country. With your action on behalf of the State of Israel, a nation quite unique in the part of the world where it stands, it's not in a good neighborhood in many ways, fulfilling its national, historical, and religious mandate as a democracy, a rare thing in that part of the world, fulfilling the hopes of its founders and of the faith in its future that our country, our leaders, since the beginning, have always shown. I thank you for the many Oregonians I represent for recognizing the sovereignty of Israel by accepting the rightness of placing our embassy in that sacred city, the chosen capital of the Jewish state. I thank you for the many Oregonians I represent and hope, as I know you do, for a peaceful future for our country, for Israel, and for the world. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romain, and I'm not representing the beer and wine distributors today. I'm representing myself here, but I am in another life. I am the chair of the Oregon chapter of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, better known as APAC, which is a group that supports the strong U.S.-Israel relationship nationally and internationally. Senate Joint Resolution is a very simple, 34 is a simple resolution. It just supports action that's already been taken. In 1995, Congress passed the Jerusalem Embassy Relocation Implementation Act. The President signed it. It calls for the U.S. Embassy to be moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. This is not a strange thing. It's strange that it's not there. The United States has diplomatic relations with 184 countries. In 183 of those countries, our embassy is in the chosen capital of that country. Israel is the only place in the world where our embassy is not located in the capital chosen by that country. The land we're talking about is land that has been part of Israel since the inception of the State of Israel. This is not post-1967 land. This is land that has always been part of the State of Israel since its recreation in 1948. In a way, I like to look at Jerusalem somewhat like Washington, D.C. When David established the capital, some 3,200 years or 3,000 years ago, it was basically a no man's land. It was not land occupied by the 12 tribes. It was occupied by others, and it was neutral. And he chose neutral land because he could unite everybody. Nobody really had any possessory interest in that particular land. It united the people. It's been the capital of the State of Israel for 3,000 years. When we left that area, or were forced out in various times, We always long to come back to it, and we have. We keep coming back to it. We built the temple. Solomon built the temple. And when the Babylonians kicked us out, we came back. When the Romans sacked the temple, second temple, we came back. We came back in 1948. We're there to stay. It's the capital of the state of Israel. And all you're doing by this resolution is simply saying we praise Congress, we praise the President for taking action that is appropriate. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
As would I.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate you bringing this forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that would close the hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 34 and open work session on Senate Joint Resolution 34.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate Joint Resolution 34 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Miller has moved Senate Joint Resolution 34 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. In discussion, clerk call the roll.
Senator Byron.
Aye.
Senator Miller.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, Senate Joint Resolution 34 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I will carry the bill. Thank you again. That we open a hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 20, and I'd like to have Senator Kim come forward and Senator Perioli is on his way, so you have backup coming.
Great. I will not say my sin. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gene Timms. I'm state senator for District Number 30, which is sort of the landmass of the state of Oregon that I represent. I just came from a Judiciary Committee, and it was interesting listening to the other Supreme Court judge and, of course, Chief Justice Carson and Judiciary Committee of the impact of initiatives in the process and how the Judiciary Department budget has gone down better than 2% in the last 10 years, which is, I think, kind of a wake-up call that, you know, there are some problems, especially with the initiative process. And, of course, Ballot Measure 5 was not passed on the rural areas, but it was passed in the urban areas, and the urban areas seem to be the ones that scream the loudest about not having school funding. So what it boils down to is local control under Senate Joint Resolution 20, which requires that 20% of the total number of signatures be gathered in each congressional district. Now, there will be some talk against this because it was defeated. It was a bill that I brought forward, or a resolution that I brought forward last session. The reason it was defeated, I feel, because I believe people in the state of Oregon believe that the initiative process should be fair, and it makes sense that you don't gather all the signatures in the Clackamas Center shopping center or the Washington Square. You should have to go over the total state of Oregon because those initiatives affect all of us. So I brought this before you because there are supporters, and there will be a few here today. I wish there were more than there is, but they encouraged me to bring it forward again. Mainly the people that get affected by the initiatives, especially in agriculture in rural parts of the state, and hope that there will be the kind of support that could make a resolution, Senate Joint Resolution 20 pass in the general election in November. With that, I'll myself open to any questions.
Are there any questions of our witness?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Miller.
The theme song of Burns, Oregon. No, Mr. Senator Timms, I have some testimony here that says that SJR 20 is the son of Measure 24 that voters rejected in May of 1996.
Right.
I'm not sure.
Well, wasn't my,
I can't remember.
Wasn't my
I was rejected.
Was
I know that. I
was very session.
Done. It was done in the 97th session, I believe. Maybe it was done in the 95th. How time does fly.
Yeah, it was.
We have 90 and 96.
Oh, good.
So it's been quite some time.
Yeah, it's been quite a while ago. People changed their mind.
Thank you. I just wanted to be clear on the fact.
Yeah. Thank you for straightening me out, Senator Miller.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. We have Don Loving, Ray Phelps. No?
Oh.
Senator Ferrioli, would you come forward?
Wow.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, State Senator Ted Ferrioli, District 28. A few statistics for the committee, Mr. Chairman, if you will. The Senate District 28 is all or parts of 11 counties, including parts of Multnomah and Clackamas County. It consists of 17,500 square miles. And a petition can be put on the ballot without a single signature from within Senate District 28. It can also be put on the ballot with a concerted effort in one or two counties. And it's been a matter of some frustration for people on the east side of the state to see that signatures can be garnered from a relatively narrow area of the state, the I-5 corridor, and bring an issue to the ballot that essentially reflects accurately, perhaps, the mentality and belief of a relatively small urban population, not small in size, but certainly small in geographic area, and yet ignore the wishes and the customs and the cultures of folks that have been living in communities for four and five generations. And that, I think, characterizes some of the frustrations that we feel when only a narrow area is needed to cover the requirement for getting an initiative on the ballot. If we had a mechanism that required folks to sell the concept on a wider geographic area, perhaps we wouldn't be seeing so much government by initiative. We would still have the ability to bring forward initiatives. They would still be, I'm certain, would still be on the ballot occasionally. But we would see a little less concerted effort at marketing a petition drive at areas like supermarkets or shopping malls. We would see more of an educational effort, more of an outreach effort, more of an informed electorate, a more broad-based interplay between the east and west and rural and urban areas. So I sincerely believe that requiring a limitation of 20% on the total of the signatures that can be gathered from any congressional district and diffusing the effort across the landscape would provide a better balance in terms of how measures get to the ballot, but it would also provide a lot better educational opportunity for people in the communities outside the I-5 corridor. So I support the bill, and I hope the committee will vote it out.
Question? Senator Mullen.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Senator Ferrioli, I don't know how many other states, probably few, have as active an initiative process as we do, but of those who have this process, are you aware of other states that might incorporate this geographic balance concept?
Chairman Starr, Vice Chairman Miller, I don't. I don't have the background on how many other states have taken this approach. But Oregon has always established itself, for better or worse, in the category of unique. And we have always done things in the Oregon way, and the initiative and the petition are two very cherished political traditions that live in Oregon and I think have wide acceptance in, among the electorate. The bill would, I think, broaden the tradition to be more inclusive of all the counties in the state of Oregon, or at least give us a better chance at broader representation. I don't know of other states that are as that have adapted or adopted this kind of a rule to require the communication with all of its congressional districts. But then again, I don't know of another state that's been as aggressive in pursuing the initiative as Oregon has become. So I think this is a fitting modification in recognition of the growth of political activism and the concentration of that activism in the populated areas.
I had a thought. I think that it's been pointed out that this failed in 96. Should we perhaps consider a little lower threshold number, like 15% minimum for each congressional district?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that there could be a number of different configurations. This was based on a simple math that we have five congressional districts and we figured an equal amount at each. There could be other configurations that would be helpful. And I'm certain that the proponents would discuss anything that diffused the opportunity for education and debate and signature gathering across the landscape. But just because your other observation, Mr. Chairman, was that this also failed in the earlier referendum, or actually an earlier referral to the people, that would be an educational opportunity in itself. It did fail, but many people discussed afterwards, maybe we should have voted for that thing. I think every time this concept gets considered, more people understand that there are good reasons to do this. And I would hope that once we referred this out, we'd do a better job of educating people about what it really intends to do. It's not an attempt to nullify the initiative process. On the contrary, it's an attempt to get more communities involved with it directly.
I appreciate that. Senator Miller.
I understand where you're coming from because in some respects you and I have unique backgrounds in that I currently continue to reside in the more metropolitan area, and yet I have strong links to more rural Oregon and used to be in the more metropolitan area and now represent an area that is more dispersed. It kind of suggests that if there is a majority of or a sufficient number of folks to get an initiative on the ballot, that they aren't as broad-minded, perhaps, as this process, as the process we are all in, when we are routinely exposed to people from other parts of the state, and I guess sensitized. Do you give any thought to a scheme that would say, if this thing gets on the ballot, or if an initiative gets on the ballot, that it would have to receive acceptance by at least a certain percentage in each of the congressional districts?
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman Miller, the looking at a percentage game or doing some percentage questions like that makes me wonder about the one man, one vote, or one person, one vote constitutionality. So if you said 15% of the folks in this area or 50% of the folks in that area, I think if you have a differential, you run into a constitutional question about whether or not people's vote is equally representative. And I think that's part of why we got to the calculation of an equal amount from each of the five congressional districts. And we've argued this thing endlessly. It just seems somehow patently unfair that the folks in one or two counties actually have the population advantage over the rest of the state to put a bill on the ballot if they so desire. And so many folks sign a petition simply because they feel Oregonians ought to be able to vote on every question. But I think there is some benefit and some reasonableness about looking at the geographic differences of the distances between east and west. Many people feel that when they've gotten to Bend, they're in eastern Oregon. And, of course, it's just not that far over to Bend from here. It's in relative terms, between Bend and the Idaho border is a lot further trip than between Bend and Salem. So many Oregonians are so focused on the valley, they just don't look beyond. And that's where our population, the heart of our culture, and the heart of our financial world is centered. But it's there are just so many efforts that are so many issues that are more higher elevation, dry land, east side, rural, agrarian. And I just think it would be more representative if we had a broader base from which to draw. I don't know if I answered your question, Senator, but I sure tried.
Did an extraordinary job. Let me ask you one more question.
Yes, sir.
The floor debate is, assuming this gets to the floor, you might well imagine would feature a question of, well, if this thing was just out there to the people in 1996, I mean, are you back too soon? Or haven't the people already decided about this? How do you respond to that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have said to myself many times, I never vote to refer another vote to the people after they voted on an issue. I came to that conclusion after having referred or voted to refer the Death with Dignity Act back for reconsideration and watched the numbers roll from 51% acceptance to 71% acceptance, primarily on a on an emotional response to a re-referral to the voter. But I feel very strongly that this is an issue that does deserve additional consideration. Yes, we will probably have a stirring debate on why don't you just listen to the way the voters have spoken. The issue for me is if it is a question of making sure we have reasonable and fair representation, the congressional districts are allocated by population. And four of them are at least partially located in the I-5 corridor. The second congressional district, as you know, wraps, I think it's the fourth or fifth largest in the United States. So it's the second and fourth, I think, that are sort of more rural for second, third being more urban. Three-fifths of the population live in the urban area covered by those three congressional districts. This somehow just seems fair to me, and I think if we explain it reasonably to people, they will see the fairness in it also. However, if this goes out to the people, and I hope it does, on the successful vote in the House and the Senate, and they choose to reject it, I guess I will come back to them before the committee at some point in time and say, well, they told us so. But I would really like to see voters have another chance to think this through and give the areas outside the I-5 corridor an opportunity to learn more about the initiatives that are being put forward and feel more active participation in the democratic process.
I said that was my last question, but I'll violate that pledge and ask one more.
Sure.
This bill currently calls for an election in the primary election date. Is that something that you thought much about or did what I usually do, send it to legislative council and they roll the dice and send you back an answer? Or is there, do you have a preference?
I believe, Mr. Chairman, I think that the bill was drafted to put the question before the voters at the next available election after the session, not strategically or looking at the relatively larger turnout at a general. I think it just was what's the next available election, and that's the date that was selected.
So it makes little or no difference to you what date is selected, or you just want the, or it does, and you want the next available.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, if the in the committee's wisdom they felt that changing to the general to give a larger population an opportunity to vote on it was your decision, that would be fine with me.
I thank you for that. And the committee thanks you.
And the committee is, I appreciate the committee's indulgence to allow my testimony. Thank you, sir.
All right. Appreciate it. We're now meeting in a subcommittee, if that was... Now we were awaiting the arrival of Mr. Loving and Mr. Phelps. Thank you, Senator Ferrioli. Now that these two witnesses have been called, I would expect more members to return.
She can say there aren't so many witnesses that we get a floor, so we can go ahead and do a tour somewhere.
A nice day, Donnie.
Very briefly, Mr. Vice Chair's last chair and member of the committee. Don Loving, Public Affairs Director for Oregon, asked me, and I actually only signed up to testify originally because Mr. Phelps and I were sort of jockeying back and forth between House rules and this committee, and it was appearing that we may not be able to jive, and so I was going to do that. And the majority parties of both houses should be pleased to know that, you know, by and large, we've contracted out most of our testimonies, Mr. Phelps here, on this issue. However, I do feel inclined to point out one thing, having read this missive back here from Ms. Bendel to your committee.
Yeah.
In her comments down here about SCR 20, she says the electorate plainly understood and wanted to avoid a situation whereby constituents in one targeted region could prevent an issue from getting on the ballot. You know, I and AFSCME would say that we think it's fair given the number of circumstances that have happened in the last 3.5 years since the first major light just went out, to turn that question around and say it warrants taking a look why should constituents in one targeted region be able to place an issue on the ballot? I mean, that's kind of what we're looking to turn the question around and take a look at that again. So that's really all I had to say. I was sort of the placeholder in case Mr. Phelps didn't get here, but I did want to respond to her letter, being that we had the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Levin. Does that mean that Mr. Phelps will not be testifying?
No, we have contracted out the majority of our comments to Mr. Phelps, sir.
All right, sir. Well, we thank you for your testimony and look forward to Mr. Phelps'
testimony. Good evening, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ray Phelps. I think that's
very early. Now the speaker witnesses have been called. I would expect more members to return.
You can say that. I mean, witnesses, we get a fourth, we can go ahead and do a course somewhere.
That's a nice day, Donnie.
Very briefly, Mr. Vice Chair / Chair and member of the committee, Don Loving, Public Affairs Director for Oregon, asked me, and I actually only signed up to testify originally because Mr. Phelps and I were sort of jockeying back and forth between House rules and this committee, and it was appearing that we may not be able to jive, and so I was going to do that. And the majority parties of both houses should be pleased to know that, you know, by and large, we've contracted out most of our testimony to Mr. Phelps here on this issue. However, I do feel inclined to point out one thing, having read this missive back here from Ms. Bendel to your committee.
Yeah.
In her comments down here about SCR 20, she says the electorate plainly understood and wanted to avoid a situation whereby constituents in one targeted region could prevent an issue from getting on the ballot. You know, I and AFSCME would say that we think it's fair given the number of circumstances that have happened in the last 3.5 years since the first major light just went out, to turn that question around and say it wants, taking a look why should constituents in one targeted region be able to place an issue on the ballot? I mean, that's kind of what we're looking to turn the question around and take a look at that again. So that's really all I had to say. I was sort of the placeholder in case Mr. Phelps didn't get here, but I did want to respond to her letter, being that we had the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Loving. Does that mean that Mr. Phelps will not be testifying?
No, we have contracted out the majority of our comments to Mr. Phelps, sir.
All right, sir. Well, we thank you for your testimony and look forward to Mr. Phelps' testimony.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ray Phelps. I think that's been well established. I'm representing Oregonians to Maintain Community Standards, American Federation of State County Municipal Employees, International Brotherhood of Electric Workers, Local 48, and we are here in support of Senate General Resolution 20. As has been discussed, the similar measure was on the primary ballot in 1996. As a side note, I think it should have been on the general. I think this ought to get the same kind of opportunity as we're looking to provide on the front end, the initiative process. We ought to try to provide the same opportunity on the election process itself at the general. The measure was defeated at the election, and in my opinion, due to the fact that complete information was not made available to Oregonians to make an informed decision. And one of the things I've learned in all the years I've bounced around in the elections business is when voters, and particularly Oregonian voters, don't have enough information, they vote no. Because they figure if it's a good idea, you'll send it back with the right information, we'll make the right decision. And I think they were right then, and I think if we take the lead from Senator Perioli and a couple of the other previous speakers on this issue, I think we'll be
will be able to provide that education. And we should ask Oregonians to reconsider their vote of 4 years ago. It is my understanding of the state's history regarding the initiative and referendum process that William Uren wanted citizens to take a more direct role in legislation, and that's the operative word, legislation. What would you be doing by referring this measure to the people is ask them to reconsider their vote now that adequate information is provided explaining the matter. That's a very similar process that the legislature uses, and then I don't know if I say daily, but very often, when the prevailing vote isn't to the desire of the majority, there's always the move to reconsider. That's what you're doing. You're asking people to reconsider. Furthermore, the current initiative legislation process has become an insider's process. And in my later tenure in the Secretary of State's office, I was watching the demise of the people's initiative process. It's not a people's process. It's an insider's process. You pay to get things on a ballot, and you pay to put special interest. We do it. Other people have done it. Placing a measure on the official ballot in most cases does not reflect the desires of a great number of majority of Oregonians, and this is evidenced by the fact that only 19 of the 49 initiated legislative measures on the ballot for the past four election cycles were approved by voters. I would be remiss at this point if I did not renew my request to this committee to refer a constitutional amendment asking Oregonians if they want the Supreme Court to determine the constitutionality of an initiated legislative measure before the people are asked to vote on it. Please recall the research of Secretary of State Kiesling, which was presented to this committee by Senator Lee Beyer. Mr. Kiesling reported to Senator Beyer that 9 of the 19 measures approved by the voters, so we've come from 49 to 9, and now 9 of those 19 have had terminal legal problems or are enjoined from taking effect pending legal action. This performance, in my opinion, is very counterproductive to the efforts described by Senator Farioli and others of all elected officials who expend their energy to encourage people to vote. This turns them off because the process is second-guessed in Oregonians, and they're not unique in this regard, but they are unique. They don't like a second guess. They don't like the ballot box being thrown away. Lastly, there is a great deal of truth to the comment often heard in this building that there are two Oregons, the highly populated areas of the state and the rest of the state. This request for Oregonians to reconsider their vote can be a signal from this body of the importance and the value this legislature places on involving all Oregonians in the discussions that are very important to their future. So I think it is very, very important that we ask people to reconsider and that we use the fullest opportunity, and that would be a general election. Those would be our recommendations. With respect to your question of Senator Farioli, there are 25 states in the United States that have the initiative process. Half of them don't. Missouri, a state I'm familiar with because I lived there before I moved here, has an initiative process. They had 10 congressional districts while I still live there. Myself and a few folks left, now they're down to 9. But when there were 10 congressional districts, it was incumbent upon initiative people that they gain a representative number of signatures, and I don't have the percentage for you, but it was not 1 and 2. But it was a representative number of signatures of 7 of the 10 districts. This is not different from that. And I think, and it has always been a frustration of mine that you can do it all in the tri-counties, and that's your two Oregons. It just keeps feeding that same perception that makes people very uncomfortable, in some cases very agitated. And I think this is a very valuable tool.
Well, I thank you. It doesn't create any searching for some constitutional objection to saying that by virtue of where you live, your signing a petition may not have the same impact as one who is living somewhere else and signs.
No, I don't think so. I give you my educated opinion, which doesn't count for very much sometimes, but basically the one person, one vote is actually when you're making the policy choice at the ballot box. That's the value and that balance. As how you do other kinds of process, it's an equity. situation. When you administer election laws, the one thing you learn very quickly is it's basically an equity process. And so it's fairness. Frankly, I would argue that the proposition before us in SCR 20 is more fair than the process you've got right now. And I think that's obvious on its face. But you would not be setting a one-person, one-vote proposition up or an infirmity because of an initiative. You might get into the class distinction situation, but this would mitigate that. If you were to have 20 each, or 18 each, or 15 each, or whatever you choose to want to do, I don't think anybody can make a class action argument if you discriminate against one kind or another. As you could possibly, for example, say, you got to get 20% in Eastern Oregon and you only have to get 10 anywhere else. I mean, arguably that I believe would be a problem.
Although doesn't it deviate a little bit from the notion that the majority of Oregonians within the state boundaries would have the ability to determine the future course of this state?
Well, I think that's always true. But I don't think, let's go back. The initiative referendum process, in my opinion, is a very valuable tool. But let's remember, it was directed toward mimicking or mirroring the legislative process. And a legislative process, as you very well know, from bill introduction to governor signing, has an awful lot of staging that goes on. You have committees, you have all these kinds of opportunities. So in my mind, it's not inconsistent, although it could be portrayed as being discriminatory against people who initiate. I do not accept that, never have. This is the legislative process of a different venue, and there ought to be some standards that people have to meet in order to achieve it, and it shouldn't be that simple. It should be valuable, and a discussion of that issue around the state, considering all the other things that this committee and the House committee is looking at on election improvement of the process, this is a small step, and I think it would be a significant improvement.
Let me ask, I'd be glad to have Mr. Loving's comments, too, on this. The last time that I ran for an office unsuccessfully, I clearly recall that the reason was that my message didn't get out. And that in measures that fail, I've often heard that, we just, enough information didn't get out.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, people who believe that their measure was superior and failed are going to have that opinion. What is it that you don't think got out in the discussion of this measure when it was on the ballot in 1996? What's the new information, or what was the previously undisclosed fact or facts that will make the difference?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Miller, one and the same, and member of the committee. Ray may have a different answer than I have to that. I just think that the huge increase in spurious measures, odd measures, extra measures that have happened the last 4 years, I think just the volume of measures and lawsuits and this is unconstitutional now that we've passed it and all that, I think that folks are willing to take a look at changing how we get to the election day with the initiatives on the ballot. I think opinions have changed just because of the 4 years that have gone by. I know people that there aren't AFSCME people or union people or Sizemore people or whatever, just tired of how many things are on the ballot, how many things they vote for to get yanked by the courts. And I just think that any way to clean that up, people would be willing to take another look at this point in time. A broader answer to your question that Ray commented on is, I still firmly like the idea of having some sort of preferably Supreme Court preview of measures, so we don't even have to mess with all this stuff if they're unconstitutional anyway. Let's only vote on things that we know we're really going to pass if we vote them in. But I just think the last 4 years will give them a number of people the opportunity to change their mind.
And before you answer, Mr. Belson, I'm struck by the letter here that you had referenced earlier, Mr. Loving, on the among those subscribing to the letter, Ruth Bendel, Dan Meath, Lloyd Marbet, somewhat diverse group philosophically, in opposition led to this bill. I guess there would be some who would have suggested that this would be, one, a restriction on the initiative, and I suppose at the very least it's a change, and people who have been active would probably have some trepidation as to wanting to embrace something that is different than the current system. Would it also be argued, and maybe there's not a whole lot to this, that some voices in the initiative process are probably described as a little bit more moderate to conservative would be heard by virtue of adopting this? I mean, because the people we see that perhaps are disenfranchised are those that aren't in the concentrated population area, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And I think by their nature, at least as reflected in the assemblies here, it's a, perhaps a little different train of thought than you get from urban Portland. And if you require a certain percentage from these outlying areas, will you get a little different mix of what is acceptable as an initiative?
From my view, and you know, it's been a while since the last class I took was in 1980 at U of O, but it's been a while since I've been in school. But my, you know, my whole remembrance of all my government classes and stuff is, you know, we have all these necessary systems of checks and balances and such. And I guess I see SCR 20 as sort of a minor modification that puts some check and balance into the initial process. That we have seen, you know, it take off in a direction that we perhaps didn't envision when we started because of the whole aura of paid petitioners. They're there to stay. You know, my organization may use them at some point in time. But it's a different dynamic when you have folks out there on a bounty hunt than it used to be when it was entirely a grassroots process. At least that's my opinion.
So what you're saying is that I just gave you a bunch of babble that's not necessarily provable until we implement it. Just a bunch of good theory.
Well, you have lots of good theory, sir.
Very good, Don. Mr. Phelps, you want to abuse me or anything?
No, sir. I never.
It's okay.
Well, it's okay. I don't even think it's all right. But nevertheless, no, I think several things. I think we need to go back to the people and point out very, very specifically and clearly that the present system is an insider system and they're being manipulated. Now, they always have that final statement, and that is yes or no. But the reality of it is it also, and this was not something that was made, it also is a distraction. It is also unfair to other candidates. It's unfair to other people who have got good measures on the ballot because it's a dilution of the system, the clutter that goes on with all the ballot measures out there because the special interests can afford to do it, is really wearing people out. Voter fatigue is probably pretty high. And it's almost to the point now where people are looking at this thing going, what in the world is going on? And I think they need to have that message and that story told to them, that it's an insider game, that you pay to put these things on, that it is no longer an initiated process envisioned by the populist people in the turn of the century. And so consequently, it has to be structured that way with that in mind. And that's why I'm drawing it back to making the analogy of a legislative process. This is nothing different than a legislative process. And I think we ought to start thinking of the initiative referendum process that way. And I think that and other kinds of information on that theme would be beneficial to Oregonians, particularly the new Oregonians that have moved in the last half a dozen years. And I don't have that statistic here, but I just watched my own neighborhood, and I tried driving around the streets of Portland, and there's a lot more folks here than there were 6 years ago, just in sheer number. I can see it. So I don't know if that answers your whole question, but that's my observation, that we need to go back to our guns and explain to them precisely what's going on and what's been asked of them and why they've been ignored. Because a good part of the people are ignored when this is in the ballot or when this is being designed in somebody's kitchen. Measure 5, my greatest example is Measure 5 was written by Jim Whitberg in a coffee shop downstairs on a ballot, on a napkin. And he ran around the coffee shop and got 25 people to sign a prospective petition, came upstairs and filed it. And that began the Measure 5 history of Oregon.
Wittenberg?
Yes, Jimmy Wittenberg.
Jimmy Dale?
That's the guy.
Indeed, I'm glad you came here tonight, Mr. Bell.
Well, you haven't eaten dinner, have you?
I thank you for that testimony.
You're welcome.
You too, Mr. Lundy.
Thank you.
Mr. Dewey and Darren... That's what I said. I'm sorry about that.
Well, it's my right.
Oh, okay. You probably will not have a work session on this bill this evening.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I saw Representative Butler back there. Are you in time constraints?
No, sir.
No, go right ahead.
All right.
We're not going to take very much time unless you ask a lot of questions.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry about that. I didn't check the witness list and just had a nice conversation with the last two witnesses.
Mike Dewey, for the record, Mr. Chair, representing the Oregon Resource League. Darren Kopic is with me, and he will provide the bulk of the comments. Darren is the executive director of the Oregon Resource League. He's coming from Oregon.
Thank you, Senator Miller. Darren Kopic, executive vice president of the Oregon Wheat Growers League from Pendleton. We're here in support of this resolution. We think that basing the number of signatures collected on congressional districts is a very fair way to do it. It balances population with geography. It balances urban with rural interests and makes sure that we don't have one portion of the state dictating to the rest of the state things that may or may not work in the entire state. The petitions collected in densely populated areas can have unintended and sometimes even malicious consequences in other parts of the state, and we hope that this particular resolution will fix that problem. We are aware that it will probably make the work of professional petitioners more difficult, but we don't think it's always bad to have some of those folks drive outside of Portland. It may be the only chance we have to show them what life's really like on a wheat farm. So I'm sad to hear that we won't have a work session. I was looking forward to see if your vote was going to be unanimous or not. Thank you for allowing us to testify. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just may make just a couple of comments. You had asked the question about perhaps why it had failed and should this come back to the voters. I would just say very quickly that the opposition to the measure ran a much better campaign. They ran a wonderful campaign. And I don't think the proponents did very well in running a campaign explaining what this was all about, because it is not easy to explain. It does take some time. Secondly, intuitively, at least for me, kind of from a political science standpoint, it seems to me there needs to be a higher standard for what ultimately is on the ballot. That is intuitive, at least in my mind. And last but not least, I think it's going to be good for the rural economy. We need the jobs in the rural economy. Busloads of people are going to come out to get the signatures. It's good for tourism, albeit temporary jobs. I think it will be helpful, and we can sell that on the floor of the Senate when this moves forward. A different angle, if you will.
Well, let me ask Mr. Kopic. You've heard probably Senator Farioli talk about, I think, maybe Mr. Phelps, the two Oregon concepts. Describe to that.
Senator Miller, I see evidence of it. I know there's been some effort to bridge the gap. Channel 12 in Portland ran a bunch of One Oregon series, which I think were excellent. But we still sense that's the case, and you see it more and more in the types of ballot measures that do make it to the ballot, things like Measure 64 in the last session. Measure 38 in the election cycle before that, which either one would have had disastrous consequences on much of the rural part of the state. So if there's a way to introduce some balance into this process so that the things that do make it to the ballot are balanced, they're well thought out, and good public policy, we think this is a great step forward.
Things like maybe bears and cougars?
Yeah, it kind of works both ways, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, I appreciate your testimony, and we will certainly share it with the remainder of the members of this committee. And I'm not sure when the chair will reschedule this, but I'm confident it will be back up.
The only if you look at the measure itself, it appears as though it might be a little bit flawed. If one, this goes into the Constitution. Two. If you have reapportionment, but with the census, and if Oregon were to get an extra, a new congressional seat, then the numbers don't work out they work out now, 20% times 5 is 100% to get there. As I recollect, the last time there was a proportionality language that the X factor divided into the number of districts. And you might want to take a look at that just to see if that is a better way to do it, so you can anticipate whether or not you have a decrease or an increase based upon the census. So it's something to take a look at.
Last I heard, we're not going to get an additional seat, but I think your point's a good one.
Yeah. So just in case.
In the event that should happen someday, then this would adjust to it. Thank you for that.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You bet. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tom Butler from Ontario, Oregon. That's House District 60. I just wanted to make three distinct points relative to Senate Joint Resolution 20. And those points you've obviously heard, but I want to try and emphasize them, if I may. This Senate Joint Resolution appears to try and tackle that rural versus metropolitan problem that we've had the perception of or the reality of through many, many years in Oregon. And I recognize that there's great opposition to the rural portions of Oregon being included even as a one-fifth voice in items of this nature. I think that rural Oregon has the distinction of being a lot closer to the earth, and a metropolitan Oregon has the distinction of being a lot closer to the cemeteries. We keep our cemeteries a long ways out, and you're right on top of them here, and I think that gives you perhaps a little more feeling of the reality of living in the urban and metropolitan way. So I've enjoyed my opportunity to be 3 months in Salem, or 3.5 months in Salem. April 15th used to be a big day in my life every year. And this year, I quite honestly have only given the thought a couple of times, you know, I still miss April 15th back home, because quite honestly, it was a lot calmer on April 15th than what it is on any day of the session here. The second concept that I would just discuss briefly with you, Mr. Chair and Senator Meyer, is the issue of the two Oregon concept that you just discussed and briefed a moment ago. The Portland Chamber of Commerce put out the brochure, the overcoming the fallacy of the two Oregon concept, and they ask 10 questions in there, and to try and show how there really weren't two Oregons. Mr. Chair, I read that. I don't read a lot of the booklets that come across my desk. Things don't get that dull. But I read that with a great deal of amusement, because the fallacies, the 10 fallacies that they brought up about what we Eastern Oregonians, we rural folk, might think of our Oregon versus the balance of Oregon. I had never heard a single one of those 10 fallacies ever in my existence as a 30-year practicing certified public accountant, as a 2-term county commissioner. I had no idea that people in the valley over here felt like that's what we thought were the issues, and what And each one of them were very well explained. I've shared this criticism with the Portland Chamber of Commerce as well, that so this is nothing brand new to those folks. But there isn't a two organ program. If we've got a two organ concept, it's wrong because there's probably three or four, maybe even five organs when you've got a coastal area, the ancient Yamhill, and then the Shampwick and the other portions of Wasco and pieces of Oregon that were recognized originally as the different parts of Oregon. And so if there's more than a one organ concept, it's got to be probably about five organs. And I would just say that probably, when you look at the five organs, maybe the five districts really do have greater weight and impact. And finally, I would just call to your attention one item that really, really distinguishes rural Oregon today from the balance of Oregon. And that would be the unemployment. When you look at Oregon and each of the counties and then start to separate off the various sections of Oregon to find out where the differences may be, I think you could probably draw pictures around portions of those organs, those different organs, if you just drew pictures around those that had high double-digit unemployment and modest double-digit unemployment, and then those that ran twice the national average of unemployment, and then those that were closer to the national average of unemployment, and then places where you can get a fairly decent job. And I think as well, that so this is nothing brand new to those folks, but there isn't a two organ program. If we've got a two organ concept, it's wrong because there's probably three or four, maybe even five organs when you've got a coastal area, the ancient Yamhill, and then the Shampwick and the other portions of Wasco and pieces of Oregon that were recognized originally as the different parts of Oregon. And so if there's more than a one organ concept, it's got to be probably about five organs. And I would just say that probably, when you look at the five organs, maybe the five districts really do have greater weight and impact. And finally, I would just call to your attention one item that really, really distinguishes rural Oregon today from the balance of Oregon. And that would be the unemployment. When you look at Oregon and each of the counties and then start to separate off the various sections of Oregon to find out where the differences may be, I think you could probably draw pictures around portions of those organs, those different organs, if you just drew pictures around those that had high double-digit unemployment and modest double-digit unemployment, and then those that ran twice the national average of unemployment, and then those that were closer to the national average of unemployment, and then places where you can get a fairly decent job. And I think, again, you'll come back to probably about a five-organ concept when you're done. And I think that when you look at that, my conviction is that Senate Joint Resolution 20 really has so much good thought behind it that I can wholeheartedly support it. And I know that's not popular. I didn't come here to espouse an idea that's necessarily popular in the shopping malls in Portland. But I came here to give you my heartfelt feeling I feel with all my heart that that the closer that we can bring the folks back to having common ideas and help recognize that we live closer to the earth, and you folks here, I say you folks here, the folks in the metropolitan area live a whole lot closer to the cemeteries than you do. It just is indicative of the direction that we're going. So I bring you those three points as issues that are important to my constituents when we consider the things that happen in the overall process of gathering signatures and dividing up Oregon further and further with constitutional amendments and other law that's brought in through the initiative process.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Let me get your understanding. Measures 38 and 64, probably two of the most ill-conceived measures that have been put before going in a long time. Maybe the two worst ever, in my judgment. They were soundly rejected. I'm not sure if 64 even won in those areas near the cemetery. Are you comforted by the fact that maybe people throughout Oregon were able to understand the impact throughout Oregon, and that the system somehow worked in that situation? Or is your feeling that if the Sen Joint Resolution 20 had been placed, you wouldn't have had to go through the ordeal of and the fright, frankly, of being challenged by either of these measures?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question is an excellent question, and we used up such a great deal of our precious little resources in fighting both of those particular ballot measures that there will be a time when we will not be able. I would think if 36 were to come, Measure 36 were to be run this next year, following the cattle prices and the amounts of foreclosures that we will have, that we will at 38, right? I beg your pardon. Oregon. I would think if 38 were run this next year, that we could not muster the resources that we were able to bring to the table to fight off these bad ballot measures. I think that Measure 64 was so ill-conceived that we could probably muster the resources in rural Oregon because it was just genuinely bad law. That's all there was to it. I mean, I couldn't think of any property that I have interests in and there aren't a lot of trees in eastern Oregon, but I couldn't think of any property that I had interest in that I wouldn't have had to have gone out and before Measure 64 became firm law, that I wouldn't have had to have spent a lot of money trying to get rid of a few pauper trees here and there to make sure that I didn't fall under the purview of that particular measure. And so I think we could probably muster a pretty good fight because it was so ill-conceived that there just wasn't anything to it. But Measure 38, I don't know that we could fight it off after next year. I anticipate, and I don't want to be the bearer of such foreboding information, but I anticipate that we will have, as a result of cattle prices, we are right now, today, we are experiencing more farm sales than we have seen cumulatively over the last 10 years in Eastern Oregon. And I'm talking about farm equipment sales, where the dirt is the next thing to go. We're in a situation where with farm prices, our produce prices, we're not going to be far from a fairly major recession in southeastern Oregon and other portions of eastern Oregon. You heard from some wheat growers today, and quite honestly, if that price doesn't come up, those folks are in pretty serious trouble, and they don't have the heavy costs in raising wheat. I recognize they don't get the yield per acre necessarily that we enjoy, but they don't have a third of the overall costs which we experience in those same wheat fields either. So I think that the issues are that one of these days, one of these really bad pieces of legislation will become law because we will be broke. And when that happens, when you have in effect broken some of the backbone of Eastern Oregon, I think that the situation could become very tenuous for the state of Oregon. Because at that particular point, we'll be responsible for a lot of counties. I have been in meetings this past year as a county commissioner where directors of state agencies have literally been offered the keys to cities. In other words, this city is now yours. The water system, the sewer system, everything that comes with the garbage collection is now yours. You can fill in the name of the director, whether it's from DEQ or any agency. Basically, the folks are saying, we don't have the resources. We're that close. And we're not that far. If Malheur County, for instance, were to receive the keys to Vail or Nissa, it could literally break Malheur County. There are counties in eastern Oregon where you're not very far from actually having to combine those counties or literally own those counties have responsibilities as part of the state legislature. And I don't know that as legislators we want to get out and go over and try and figure out who we're going to hire to run the sewage plant or the water lagoon system or those other kinds of things. But that's how close we are to the edge of coming off the end of this with our fiscal resources in many places. And that sounds pretty drastic, but at the same time, we own the city. Malheur County owns the town right now. The city of Jennifer is disincorporated, and with a fairly regular degree of turnover, those city lots get turned over. Most of them are pasture, but we have the responsibility of trimming the trees that are up and down the highway there and that go back in. Those trees are on public rights of way, and that's our responsibility as a county road shop to go in and trim those trees. Can't cut them down, but we've got to trim them. We've got to keep cleaning them up after them, and it's, quite honestly, a pretty big chore. But if one of the other small towns were to ever kick in the keys, and unfortunately, like I say, I've been in meetings in two different cities in eastern Oregon, where the keys have been offered to state directors to say, we can't accomplish what you're after. The economy of it is such that it could just destroy our county. We just don't have the resources, and then we're going to have some real difficulties as that rural portion of eastern Oregon or the rural portions of Oregon were ever filled up. And so I think that brings you a bit of degree of the sense of desperateness that we sometimes feel when these things are cast upon us, and we have visions of people sitting outside on card tables with little umbrellas over them outside of two or three malls in the metropolitan area, gathering all of the signatures that are necessary to go ahead and put these things together, and virtually no signatures are gathered from that particular 20% of the state, that particular district, if you will. So I just look at you and say, with all my heart, I feel very strongly. I know there's a great deal of opposition to it. I don't know that we'll be able to turn the tide back. But I would be remiss if I didn't come to you today and tell you how very important it is that we recognize one man, one vote, one district, one opportunity to say yes or no to some of the issues that come before us in the forms of ballot measures which really bear no semblance of reality.
Thank you, Representative.
More questions?
Appreciate your testimony.
He wants, Senator Beyer wants to have a happy day. He doesn't want to hear any more of my...
I was there the last time. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Joint Resolution 20? Yes, sir.
Come on up.
Sure.
My name is Terry Lammers. I sometimes represent a forestry organization, but today I will not be speaking for that organization. I will be representing Lammers Forest Limited, a business that my brother and I manage and is owned by my family. I was very active in the No on 64 campaign, and I agree with everything that Representative Butler stated about the quality of that initiative. And I have a degree in economics, and a professor back in college said it sometimes works to take things to the extreme, take things farther than they can possibly go, just to analyze the system. And if we do that with Senate Joint Resolution 20, let's put all the people in one corner of the state, or perhaps 95% of the people. That 95% of the people would have the power to dictate on, let's say, 10% of the landmass, a great deal of activity for the other 95% or 90% of the land area, where only 5% of the people reside. I guess the question would be, should there be some representation on a ballot measure from that other 5% of the people? I think there should be. All I had to say.
Lammers, where are you from?
Polk County, just west of here.
Mm-hmm.
I live here near Dallas.
Right. Well, I know this part. And I suspect even there, do you have this feeling that you're under attack from people a bit further north?
Well. Mr. Chair,
just don't have some of the understanding and sensitivity that would be helpful?
Mr. Chair, yes. I'm not sure if under attack is the right statement, but we've been Tree Farmer of the Year in Polk County on two separate occasions and the runner-up to the state winner on one occasion. And yet I attend meetings where I am ridiculed for cutting trees down. And I've been in social situations where I've said I'm a forester, and I consider myself a forester, though my degree is in economics, because I've, based on knowledge. And I said, well, I'm a forester, and immediately people have just looked at me like I was, say, in India, the lowest class, and you know, the scourge of the earth. Well, I've witnessed that, and I think it's not in any way positive to the discussion. And Senator Ferrioli made some very good statements, and I agree with everything he said. So.
As a citizen and a voter, an observer of this process and participant in this process, what about the notion that if we had sent out this proposition 4 years ago and the people made their judgment, just if you were back in Polk County or go back there tonight, would you run into people who say, you know, those legislators, how many times do we have to tell them? Don't they listen to us? You know, what are you thinking? Is this defensible to try again?
Well, Mr. Chair, I believe it is. If they did say that to me tonight, I'd say, well, in fact, I testified on their behalf. But
would you expect to hear that criticism?
Oh, from some people, perhaps. But I think I read an article, I didn't say that it was in the Wall Street Journal, 2 weeks ago, perhaps, about the initiative process. And if I remember right, Oregon has more initiatives on the ballot than any other state. And roughly, I believe it's a third of the total initiatives in the entire United States. And if you looked at the last ballot, I forget the number that was on there, but it was substantial. And I later heard people saying, well, how did you vote on that? Now, I study the information, and before I go in to make a vote, I've studied it, I know the issues. But I heard afterwards some people saying, well, how did you vote on that? And if I could have told them and why, but other people said, well, which one was that about? No, I don't know which way I voted on that. What did it do? And that upsets me, and it also tells me that there are too many initiatives and the people are not aware of the implications of those initiatives and their vote on them. So.
All right. Well, everybody?
I just want to comment. I had the same reaction about too many initiatives, but I think your numbers of the Wall Street Journals might have been inaccurate. I was surprised last time I looked. The initiative sort of wave is really the entire 8 western states. All have the joy of multiple items on the ballot. In fact, I was surprised. I think Colorado and New Mexico actually have more than we are. Surprising to see, but I would agree with you, it's far too many.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else wishing to testify on the Joint Resolution 20? If not, we will close the public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 20. Anything further to come before the committee? If not, we are adjourned. Thank you.